Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Happy birthday, White Album. You look great. You sound fantastic. But you're still a little weird. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on the show, The Beatles' White Album turns 40. And later, biographer Philip Norman has unraveled some details about the most puzzling Beatle of all. He joins us to talk about his book, John Lennon, The Life. 40th birthday parties, well, let's face it, they can be a bit of a drag. The cake with the candy tombstone, the Mylar balloons that read Over the Hill, and all that teasing about the big 4-0. But for today, forget all that. The self-titled Beatles opus that we've come to call the White Album turns 40 this week. And you can call it what you want, massive or messy, ambitious or bloated, it is definitely not Over the Hill. The White Album is still the high-water mark for experimental rock, and we want to hear what you think about it in a moment. But first, Zeth Lundy of the culture site PopMatters.com joins us to help dig into what he calls the first postmodern pop album. Zeth joins us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. Zeth, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thanks, John.
So you write that the White Album is a perennial fan favorite, but it is actually the least Beatles-esque of all their albums. How so?
Well, it's kind of the moment when their collective consciousness splintered into four pieces, you know. Before the White Album, they would kind of all assemble together and cut their records together as a collective unit. Paul and John would write most of the material together, or they would help each other finish their songs. And then for this album, they all kind of went off and did their own thing, and sometimes recorded songs on their own. Other times, only one or two of the other Beatles would help them finish recording them. So I think in that way, it's sort of the least Beatles-esque because it's really not following the classical template of who we've come to see the Beatles as.
So we come to see them as a kind of, you know, an organic unit of four people who are collectively somehow more than the sum of their parts. The White Album, are you saying, is all about the parts?
Yeah, it is all about the parts. I mean, it's a mess of parts, and it's actually something of a miracle that they assembled it into a running order that makes some kind of sense. You know, that's actually engaging.
Is there a coherence to the White Album in your opinion?
Well, I mean, I think the theme is probably incongruity. You know, but I think it does. I think it flows nicely. I particularly like how you've got, you know, songs about, like, Revolution right up next to Honey Pie, which is right up next to Savoy Truffle, you know, political song, old British music hall, sort of pastiche, and then a song about candy rotting out your teeth. I love how it kind of jumps around like that. And
Well, I mean, it's literally just called The Beatles, but we've come to call it The White Album, and it is a two-LP set that is truly weird, for exactly the reasons that Zeth Lundy just told us, beginning with the world's first surf song turned political commentary. And on the same collection, you have a Beatles song that delves into the avant-garde and the world of tape music, or musique concrète, as it was known. And a touching, timeless pop song, again, on the same album.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise.
So, three very, very different sounding clips, all from The Beatles, the official name of the album that we know as The White Album. It's celebrating its, or we're celebrating, its 40th anniversary this week, and my guest is Zeth Lundy. He's the music columns and features editor at popmatters.com.
Today on the Soundcheck blog...
Hearing the White Album in its entirety for the first time was like listening to a radio station where multiple crazy DJs were shoving each other out of the way to get their records on the air.
For the rest of the story, go to the Soundcheck blog at WNYC.org.
And we want to know what you think about the White Album. Where does it rank in the Beatles canon? What does it mean to you? You can give us a call at 212-433-9692 or leave a comment on the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org. The number again is 212-433-WNYC. So, Zeth, this idea of all these disparate styles of music all, you know, jockeying for position on this two-record set, it is a mess. I guess the question is it a beautiful mess or is this the sound of things falling apart?
Well, I guess that depends on how you look at it. You know, it's kind of like Los Angeles in that it's, you know, 30 songs in search of a theme, you know, like 30 suburbs in search of a city or something. I don't know. It's the template, though, for the overly ambitious modern album, though, don't you think? I mean,
is that what you meant by calling it the first postmodern pop album?
Well, I think what I meant by that was that it mines all these tried and true rock and pop forms, you know, Chuck Berry rock and roll, Beach Boys pop, British blues rock, pastoral folk music, while being at the same time self-referential and satirical and absurd and also dead serious at the same time. So I guess that's what I meant by it being a postmodern pop album. But I guess you could also say it the other way as well.
Uh-huh. But you're also saying that it kind of set the bar for these hyper-ambitious concept albums that would be coming our way in the 70s?
Sure. All right. And even up, you know, in the 80s, the 90s, and,
right,
and now.
Right.
It's almost like, you know, it's almost like you're not a true artist until you finally make that big, bloated, you know, overly ambitious musical statement. You know what I mean? Which is not really a statement at all. It's just this, fountain of stuff. You know?
Well, you use the word ambitious. Let me ask you about that, Seth. I mean, the song, for example, Glass Onion. John Lennon wrote that song and basically considered it a knockoff, you know, almost used exactly that word to, you know, it's just something I tossed off. And yet people can kind of ponder the layers of meaning and hidden significance of this song. Is there an irony in the way that the songwriter and those of us who listen to the song approach something like this?
Perhaps. I think that happens a lot when an artist or songwriter writes a song and they see it as one thing, and then we as listeners see it as something else, or perhaps you put your own perspective into it, or I put my own perspective into it. But regardless of what Lennon said he thought about Glass Onion or what he really thought about Glass Onion, that's sort of like the height of the self-referential aspect of the record. Where it sort of destroys all these myths, you know, myths of the Beatles themselves, like the Paul is dead myth, and also of their songs. There's no significance beyond the facade, but beyond the form of the song.
Right. And playing with the Paul is dead thing and kind of tweaking his audience's collective nose with, you know, I told you the walrus was Paul and all that
right.
kind of stuff. Here's the song. It's Glass Onion from the Beatles' White Album.
I told you about strawberry peel.
All right, that's John singing about Paul. On the Beatles White Album and the song Glass Onion, we're speaking with Seth Lundy from PopMatters.com, who all this week are celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Beatles White Album. And we've got a number of our Soundcheck listeners on the line. Let's go to Asher, who's here in New York. Asher, where do you think the White Album ranks among Beatles albums?
It's definitely always been my favorite. I think that there's a real sort of, you can hear them trying to one-up each other on the songs. You know, there's a divergence in their songwriting for the first time on that record, where it's almost like, you know, four solo albums. But I feel like each one is like a tag, you're it, like each track sort of is like, okay, now how are you going to do this, Paul, John, you know?
So in other words, here's my song, what do you got?
Yeah, and somehow it manages to still like have that feeling and also feel very together, like they still care about each other very much, you know?
That's an interesting take. Seth, what, I mean, we've heard a lot of people over the years saying, you know, that it sounds like four distinct artists all working, you know, kind of separately, but that can either sound like people who are being collegial and having a good time, or it can sound like, you know, people who are generally genuinely trying to needle each other and one up each other. Where do you fall in that discussion?
I think that it sounds like they're having a blast, which we know for a fact they weren't, or most of the time they weren't. You know, this is the record when Ringo quit for a while, and Jeff Emmerich, who was one of their top engineers, he quit during the making of this record. But I like that idea of the one-upmanship, though. I mean, I think it's possible that a song like Martha, My Dear, actually was written and recorded to sort of one-up Happiness is a Warm Gun.
Uh-huh.
Both of them sort of have that multiple section quality. And I think maybe it's possible that Paul, once they recorded Happiness, said, well, that's pretty cool, I want to do the same thing with that, and then went off and did Martha, My Dear, which also has multiple parts. So I like that idea of
the one-upmanship,
the little gamesmanship
among the band.
Yeah, exactly.
We're speaking with Seth Lundy from PopMatters.com. Jeffrey from East Elmhurst, leaving a comment on the busy Soundcheck page of our website, writes, it's definitely not one of my favorites, talking about the White Album. Sgt. Pepper, Revolver, Rubber Soul are for me much better albums, both in concept and listening pleasure. I also feel that multi-record sets have proven for most artists to be too self-indulgent messes, not just for the Beatles. In fact, Seth, George Martin, the producer of the Beatles, said that the White Album should have been a single LP. And, you know, it kind of strikes me as sounding like a single record with a whole bunch of outtakes and B-sides and things that, you know, should have been released separately as kind of basement tape stuff. Where was the editorial process here?
There was no editorial process.
Okay.
I mean, well, at least they cut down. At least they didn't release a 27-minute version of Helter Skelter, which is where that song was at one point.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, I think that's kind of part of the charm of the White Album, is all these little pieces, these, you know, ideas and fragments and pieces of songs can be songs. You know, you don't have to have all these perfect, impeccably written songs. You can kind of have a collection of ideas. And I think that works well. And I think that also sort of redefined what a pop album could be, that it didn't have to adhere to, you know, 10 songs, 35 minutes, and, you know, you're out.
Okay. Let's take another call. Dave joining us in Roxbury, New Jersey. Dave, what's your opinion of the White Album?
Yes, hi, guys. Well, I wanted to say it's definitely my top Beatles album, but I'm a musician, and it probably enriched my musical life, you know, probably more than any other album that I have in my collection. But I'm joking, of course, here, and it probably at the same time ruined my chance for commercial success because of my idea that this template of having this one band cover so many different styles on one album, and to me it worked tremendously well, that I think that idea is a wonderful idea, but of course we know it's not really commercially viable.
All right, let's get another voice. And Sophie is here with us in New York. Sophie, do you agree? Are you also a fan of the White Album?
I am a really big fan of the White Album, actually. It's one of my favorites, along with Let It Be. And I think that the reason is because it's so atypical of the Beatles. And you can look at their other albums and they are set, as you said before, you know, these, like, set songs with their set times, and they work together. But what's so great about the White Album is that it doesn't necessarily. I mean, you have Good Night, the last song on the second disc, but then you also have Helter Skelter. You also have Why Don't We Do It in the Road, which is basically just two lyrics repeated over and over again. And in a way, they're just kind of going in such a different direction than the music industry often does, and just playing what they want to play and not playing for necessarily the mass media, but they're just playing almost whatever pops into their head, and it works. Well, and they make it work.
Okay. Thanks, Sophie. I mean, Zeth, both of the callers there are obviously really enjoying the eclecticism of the White Album. But, you know, I asked you before, where was the editorial process? And you said there really was none. How does a song like Obladi Oblada get onto, you know, such a monumental effort from arguably the most important band of its time?
What are you saying about Obladi Oblada?
What I am saying, Seth, is that this song is on Blender's 50 Worst Songs Ever list, and even the other members of the Beatles, other than Paul, hated it. So I guess my question is, what?
Paul must have really lobbied for it to get on, because I think they worked on this one for like 10 days straight.
Yeah.
Maybe not straight, but 10 days total. And
John referred to it as Paul's granny crap, except he used another word for crap. But yeah, as you say, it made it onto the disc, so here it is. For better or worse, The Beatles from the White Album. Still to come, we'll find out why the Beatles' White Album was somewhat of a precursor for both punk and kids' music. And later, new revelations about one Beatle, John Lennon, will hear about his Oedipal complex, his real feelings for Paul, and much more. Stay tuned. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now with our look into the White Album. The self-titled Beatles record turns 40 this week, and we want to hear what you think about this 30-song mess, or whatever. Mess or masterpiece. Where does the White Album rank in the Beatles catalog? What does the White Album mean to you personally? You can join the callers on the line at 212-433-WNYC. That's 433-9692. Or leave a comment on the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org. We're speaking with Seth Lundy, who is the music columns and features editor at PopMatters.com. He's on the line with us from WGBH in Boston. Seth, let me read you a comment from Eli in Plainsboro, New Jersey, who is responding to other comments already left on our website, agreeing with someone, wasn't the White Album patched together to comply with record contract requirements? Abbey Road is a much better album, and also agreeing with another listener who wrote in, While My Guitar Gently Weeps stands out as perhaps the best rock and roll song the Beatles ever recorded. So here's the thing with the White Album. You have this masterpiece, While My Guitar Gently Weeps, the George Harrison tune, and then you have what we just heard, John Lennon, Revolution No. 1, false start and all, and it makes it onto the disc. You know, it's just there is a lot to like, and there is a lot that you could conceivably point to and say, these guys were just filling time, you know? They were just filling the details of a contract.
Yeah, I mean, it is true that they got out of their contract with EMI by releasing all these songs. It is true that you've got... again, I mean, it's great how, or in my mind, it's great. And this is probably all the people who have called in and said that they love the White Album. For some reason, this album, when you really love this album, you really, really love this album. And so I think you kind of take it warts and all, you know. And for me, that's the appeal. It's the warts and all. It's the false starts and people yelling off in the distance. And that's one of the fun things about this is kind of discovering all those little those little secret things that have kind of hidden in the nooks and crannies at the beginning of songs, at the end of songs, in the middle of songs. There's all kinds of stuff. I mean, I'll be listening to it in the next 20 years and still be hearing stuff I haven't heard before.
So that kind of unvarnished quality to it is actually something that people respond to. Is that the beginnings of the whole DIY trend that came with punk and later with indie rock?
I think it kind of is. You know, I think that this album kind of destroyed the notion that the way a professional pop or rock album is made is that a band walks into a studio, stands around a couple of mics, and cuts songs live. You know, that they just they do things in piecemeal, one person at a time, two people at a time, five people at a time. You know, you bring in Eric Clapton and he plays guitar. You kind of do whatever you want. And I think I think it does. I think it's sort of looked forward to what was to come in DIY and punk music.
Well, and especially a song like the raw energy of Helter Skelter is kind of a precursor of the punk sound. But there are lots of other things that the White Album looks forward to as well, punk being just one of them.
When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. Where I stop.
And also, the White Album takes a look ahead to indie rock's introspective bedroom pop with John's song, Julia.
So I sing the song of love, Julia, Julia. Seashell eyes, windy smile.
And maybe even the seeds of Kid Rock were sown on the White Album with Piggies.
Have you seen the little piggies crawling in the dirt? And for all the little piggies, life is getting worse. Always having dirt to play around in.
So some more excerpts from the Beatles' two-record set that was called simply The Beatles, but universally known as The White Album. And indeed, it was white, a plain white cover. Anything but plain on the inside, though, and we've got a lot of Soundcheck listeners calling in to tell us what they think about the White Album. Let's put a couple of dissenting voices on the air. David with us from Staten Island. And Sam is with us in Manhattan. Guys, welcome. David, let me ask you first. What do you think about the White Album?
Well, like I mentioned, didn't really want to be on the air, but if you look at it as a single album, which all the other Beatle albums were, it wouldn't really fare well. Perhaps because it's a double album, it's getting a lot more attention. And once again, George Harrison was left out, Lennon and McCartney trying to hog everything up, whereas Harrison comes out in the end with the classic Why My Guitar.
Right. It is, as you say, one of the classic tracks from the record. But you think despite the presence of that song, it doesn't lift the whole two-record set high enough for your taste?
No, and I have the original. I have some of the other originals. You know, Peppers and Abbey Road, by far, much better, in my humble opinion.
All right. Sam, here in Manhattan, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I think the screener got it wrong. I think it's an unbelievably great record. But it seems to me, I'm a classical musician, I'm not a scholar of this sort of thing, but I would think that any time you wonder how a record got, how a cut, other than some of the obviously self-indulgent things that you mentioned before where they just felt like putting something on. It seems that so many of these pieces are just unbelievably virtuosic parody that I don't know that much about the popular music of the time, but if you went through the top 40s of that time, I wonder if you couldn't find smooth kind of writing like in Julia that they just outdid. I mean, the Beach Boys, the Beach Boys parody is just perfect. It seemed to me, Why Don't We Do It in the Road has the kind of mindless lyrics of some of the Rolling Stones stuff. It seems like they were making fun of Mick Jagger to me, even though I don't know much about that. But it seems that might be a way to approach, try to figure out why some of those things are on there.
Zeth, that's also an idea that has been floated from time to time, the idea of the White Album as parody, which doesn't take away from the seriousness of some of the songs, and we've mentioned, several people have mentioned, While My Guitar Gently Weeps, so it seems like that's a fitting one to conclude with. But let me ask you, why is this album still important? Why celebrate it there at popmatters.com for a whole week this week?
Well, for all the reasons we've talked about so far, but I guess regardless of whether you're a fan of this, if this is your favorite Beatles record or your least favorite Beatles record, I think that it was a pretty monumental moment in pop music history, and again one that sort of foreshadowed a lot of things to come, and I think it will continue to resonate.
Seth Lundy is the music columns and features editor at PopMatters.com, and you can check our website to see a link to the Pop Matters feature on the Beatles' White Album, 40 years old this week. Seth, thanks for being with us on the program today.
Thanks, John. My pleasure.
And thanks to everybody who's called in or left a comment on the Soundcheck page. The conversation continues on the Soundcheck page of our website, WNYC.org. And in a moment, a new book goes to the roots of John Lennon's many contradictions. We'll talk to the author of John Lennon, The Life. And tomorrow, a live performance by one of the many Beatles-esque bands of today, the Brooklyn group called Department of Eagles. That's tomorrow on Soundcheck.
Oh.